Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organisation, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This week, as part of our podcast series on fermented foods, we're highlighting an episode from our archives, The Science of Fermented Foods, Part 1. This episode features fermented foods expert and former ISAP board member, Professor Bob Hutkins, speaking about how fermented foods are created and how live microorganisms may contribute to their health benefits. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And we are the hosts of this podcast. And today's guest is Robert Hutkins, who is a professor in the Food Science Technology Department at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And Bob, you're a fellow member, together with Dan and myself, of the board of ISAP, so we know each other very well. Tell us, how fermented foods, what are they, and how did you get into this field of research?
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast and to talk about fermented foods, one of my favorite subjects scientifically, as well as at the dinner table. When you ask for, you know, what are fermented foods, it depends to a certain extent on whom you ask. So there are rather generic definitions and scientific definitions. I think if you ask somebody off the street what are fermented foods, they're going to define it on the basis of foods that they think of. So yogurt or cheese or beer. But I prefer scientific definitions. And indeed, ISAP met and convened a panel and came up with a scientific definition, I think, that's broader than just the yogurt and the cheese definition that people think of. So we define fermented foods as those foods made through desirable microbial growth and enzymatic conversions of food components. And it's a broad definition, but it does have some important implications because it uses that word desire. So all foods have microbes and with microbial activities, and some foods will spoil with uncontrolled microbial activities, but in fermentation, we have desired microbial activities, and that leads to the products that we're familiar with, like the yogurt and cheese and sausage and so forth.
And how did you come to work in this field?
Well, that's a great question, and I'll tell you a short story. So many years ago, when I was just starting graduate school, I was given two options. One was to grow up liters and liters of Staph aureus enterotoxin, concentrate it, purify it, put it in bananas and feed it to monkeys, and then watch for them to respond. And my second option was to study how yogurt microbes metabolize sugars. So that was kind of a no-brainer for me. I took the latter, and boy, was I glad that I worked on that project, because it opened up all sorts of doors for me in a 40-year career in fermented foods.
And you said a lot of interesting things so far, but you said that the fermented foods are the result of desired microbial action on the food. And how can you desire that to happen? How can you make food ferment in the way you want it to, rather than the kind of rotting or you know, spoiling of food that you mentioned?
So there are several ways that fermentations are initiated historically, as well as to the present day. So historically, the early practitioners of fermentation relied on just a natural fermentation. They would throw some salt, peter, or some sort of ingredient that provided some form of selection for the right microbes, but it was still kind of hit or miss. Eventually, those early practitioners came to use a technique called backslopping, where they took a portion of a successful fermentation, whether it be cheese or beer or other products, and used a portion of that to inoculate the fresh raw material, again, milk, meat, and so forth. And that worked pretty well. But nowadays, we use starter cultures. So those are defined microbes that have much more consistent, repeatable properties of those that I indicated before. They give you the acceptable or the desirable properties that you want in that finished product. But I would say that all three of those are still used around the world. So where they don't have access to starter cultures, they will use a backslopping or a spontaneous or natural fermentation. And in some cases, that's the preferred way to go. So when we make products like kimchi or sauerkraut, you don't use a starter culture. You rely on the natural microbes that are already there to provide the fermentation.
And so a lot of these fermented foods then contain these living microbes still when the consumer eats them. Not all, of course. Some are heated maybe after production. These living microbes, are they important, do you think, in terms of the health benefits of fermented foods?
So here we get to the real heart of the matter and the topic that I think has really captured a lot of attention among the fermented foods consumers and fermented foods industry. And that is, what are those live microbes do for my health? And as much as I would like to say that we have the evidence that fermented foods with live microbes do provide health benefits, there's the data to say that isn't quite there yet. For some foods, perhaps, for yogurt and some of the cultured dairy products that contain live microbes, I think there is compelling evidence for a number of health benefits. But for sauerkraut and kimchi and a whole range of other fermented foods, we really don't know quite yet if those live microbes provide a clinically proven health benefit.
So we're straying kind of close to the topic of probiotics, which are live microbes that have a demonstrated health benefit. So many people might be a little bit confused about the line between a fermented food and a probiotic. Are they mutually exclusive? Can they overlap? Can you speak about that?
Sure. So they do overlap, and we'll get to that in a second. But again, probiotics also have a definition. And so ISAP defined probiotics as live microbes that, when administered in an adequate amount, confer a health benefit on the host. And again, there's some implications with this definition. Number one, that they're alive. Number two, that we know the identity of those microbes, and we even know all the way to the strain level who they are. So for example, when I say strain level, I'm talking about genus, maybe it's Lactobacillus or Streptococcus, species, Bulgaricus or Thermophilus, and then the strain level. So a probiotic will be identified all the way to that level. And I would say that for most probiotics, they're characterized all the way to the genome level. So we have a genome sequence for most of those documented probiotics. For fermented foods, rarely do we have any of that information. So a kimchi produced in Cork, Ireland, and a kimchi produced in Lincoln, Nebraska, will have probably quite different microbes and quite different amounts of those microbes. And they'll be, in general, they may be similar, but the specific species and strains will likely be different. We won't know how many are there necessarily. So we're missing a lot of information on the microbes in fermented foods. So we can't say that they're probiotic because we don't even know who they are, much less whether they have a health benefit.
Here, you know, what's really important is the state of the evidence, and that evolves over time. Bob touched on the history of fermented foods. He's literally written the book on fermented foods, and it starts off with a wonderfully readable chapter on the history of fermented foods through the ages. So, Bob, what do you think about the fact that humans have consumed and found beneficial fermented foods, you know, over the centuries, and how that should inform as we try to gather evidence that's meets the current standards of evidence for today for what's a health benefit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For sure, the motivation for humans to begin to ferment foods and to accept fermented foods as a technology resulted from their enhanced food safety and preservation. So for tens of thousands of years that humans have made and consumed fermented foods, that was probably the main motivation, was that they lasted a long time and they prevented you from getting sick from eating that meat or from eating that dairy product or whatever it happened to be. It's only in the past 100 or so years, really, that humans began to consume fermented foods for their health benefits, going back to Metchnikoff at the beginning of the 20th century. And that's really continued and up to today, and probably in the last generation, last 25 years, all of a sudden fermented foods have become so popular. And I think in large part because of this health benefit that people expect when they consume these foods. The challenge is, as I mentioned before, there are very few documented health benefits from kombucha, from kimchi, from sauerkraut. And that's because there have been so few clinical studies done in a a randomized controlled manner to show that there's health benefits. And this has been one of the big challenges for the field is conducting these studies, how they ought to be conducted, bringing in statisticians and doing them in the right way. But there are so few. I was just reading a 2020 review, and I've written on this myself, that when you add up the randomized controlled trials for just about everything other than cultured dairy products, you're looking at 10, 15, 20 such trials. So there aren't very many, and that's where we're at today, with just a shortage of these studies. And they're challenging to do. How do you do a kimchi study? What's the control group? Not eating kimchi, or you make some sort of cabbage slaw mixture that's not fermented? So these are challenging studies to do.
Well, one of the interesting things is that you always want to weigh the benefit against the risk. And so do you have any particular concerns about the potential harm, or do you generally recognize as safe the fermented foods that you come across in Nebraska? And then while you're traveling, would you have different concerns about what you might encounter then as something that's called a fermented food?
Well, they have a remarkable track record of safety. That's not to say that there aren't some issues that we have to be concerned about. Some of the microbes that are used as cultures or that are present in fermented foods may produce metabolites, biogenic amines. There's one category that could cause a very mild form of food poisoning. In fact, a lot of culture companies will screen those strains out. It's possible, although again, rare, that some of those starter culture strains could contain genes for antibiotic resistance. Again, those are usually screened out. Probably the more common concern would be fermented foods that have a lot of salt. So if you're on a salt restrictive diet, then you have to steer clear of some of those fermented foods. Likewise, if you're on a no alcohol diet, and some religions prohibit alcohol, some people are just concerned about alcohol consumption, then kombucha, maybe kefir might have a little alcohol that you might not expect.
Can you give us any sense, Bob? You're talking about live microbes present in fermented foods, but what kind of numbers are they present at? You know, I know that microbes, you know, we'd normally talk in log scales and things like that, but can you give people a sense of how many microbes you might expect in a fermented food versus its raw equivalent?
Sure.
And balance that against how many microbes we have in our gut. You know, like, is it plausible to think that it could matter?
Great question. So first, let me just dispel this myth that all fermented foods contain live microbes. So as Colin mentioned, I think earlier on, that a lot of fermented foods are heat processed. So a lot of the fermented vegetables that you find on the grocery store shelf are heat processed. And so they're pasteurized. There's no microbes in there to speak of. And then other products like wine and beer have steps, filtration, for example, that might remove those microbes. And then there's foods like breads that are baked. So those foods are devoid of microbes. But there are some fermented foods that contain appreciable numbers of microbes. So many of the cultured dairy products will contain tens of millions of live microbes, and that's per gram. So if you ate 100 gram serving, in theory, you could get 100 million, maybe a billion live microbes. If you'd ate that every day, even though those microbes don't colonize and become established in your GI tract, if you ate a billion a day, every day, in my view, for all practical purposes, they're kind of long-term residents. If you stop eating that yogurt, they'll go away. But as long as you're eating that yogurt, they're there. Now, to Dan's question about, will that make a difference? Oh, we probably have about 10 to the 14th. That's a big number. A billion of that is 10 to the ninth. So they're still outnumbered. You know, they could be outnumbered 1,000,000 to 1. But that's not to say that minority members of a community can't still function and provide some impact on that total microbiota, even though they are outnumbered.
And I think it's important to say in that context that, you know, we have 10 to the 14, as you said, microbes in our gut, but most of those are in the colon. And so in the upper reaches of the gut, the small intestine, we have far fewer bacteria. So ingesting all these fermented microbes, you know, they're actually, they may not be dominant, but they're probably pretty abundant in those parts of the gut.
And I would add to that, Colin, that, you know, geography is everything. And, you know, not, you know, location, location, location. It's not just real estate, but in the gut, you know, there's the lumen, there's all these villi, depends on where you're located. So there could be regions where the numbers are higher or lower, and there could be more competitive opportunities depending on that individual is eating. So in some fermented food, fermentation-derived microbes might be very good, for example, at consuming certain fibers. And if the diet is high in those fibers, then you have a resource for those microbes. And so they can become a bit better established in certain regions of the gut.
But Bob said location, location, location. As a statistician, I would say also numbers, numbers, numbers. Bob, let's clarify the overlap between fermented foods and probiotics. What are some of the fermented foods, the popular ones that are available to us that typically do have amounts that are sufficient to confer a health benefit? In other words, what do you think of as a fermented food that is also a probiotic?
So again, fermented foods will not be, you can't categorize them as probiotic unless you know who they are, what they're doing, how many are there, and you've done a clinical trial. I mentioned the yogurts probably have the most, but a fresh kimchi, fresh sauerkraut, other dairy products I should mention too, the kefirs will be just about as good as the yogurts. Some of the fresh vegetables will contain 1 million, 10 million, maybe more per gram. Miso, some of the soy fermented foods contain appreciable amounts as well. So you can, I've pointed this out before, that if you live in the Netherlands, that has the highest consumption of yogurt in the world, you'll get a lot of yogurt in your diet. If you live in Korea, where they might consume kimchi 2 or 3 times a day, you'll get a lot of microbes in your diet. In my view, the problem with the so-called Western diet is not only that the food that you get from a fast food restaurant or that you heat up in your microwave, that they're high in fat, sugar, salt, low in fiber, but they're devoid of microbes. So if you eat a Western diet that consists of a Starbucks and a muffin for breakfast, a Happy Meal for lunch, a microwave frozen food for dinner, you might get no microbes in your diet. And unfortunately, that's a very common occurrence.
And we can predict, I suppose, or can we even show historically that our ancestors would have consumed lots of live microbes. And of course, we have a very active immune system and enteric nervous system in the gut. Is it plausible that, you know, the human intestine essentially evolved to expect lots of live microbes, and this absence of microbes could be linked to maybe some modern health issues?
That's the popular thinking these days, is that the absence of these live microbes and the absence of that communication with our immune system is responsible for a lot of these kind of Western diseases, autoimmune diseases and food allergies, not to mention worse things like ulcerative colitis or inflammatory bowel disease or some of these other very serious diseases that were probably unheard of 100 or 200 years ago. And so that's the interesting hypothesis, hard to prove. But I would also say that not only were our ancestors consuming, again, raw, unprocessed foods with lots of microbes, and they weren't necessarily fermented, but lots of microbes, there's evidence to suggest that they were also consuming, and this is a point I made before, maybe 100 grams of what we call prebiotic fibers. And so not only were they consuming the live microbes, but our ancestors were probably also consuming the resources, the nutrients that favored the growth of those microbes in the gut.
So it's kind of a silly question in a way, but I leave some milk in the kitchen and I forget about it and I leave it go and it goes sour. Is that now a fermented food or is that just spoiled food? Is there much of a difference?
So I consider food spoilage and fermented foods are opposite sides of the same coin. It could very well be that the microbe that spoiled that milk that you left on the countertop, it could be a Lactococcus lactis, the same microbe that's responsible for making sour cream or certain cheeses, but done under controlled conditions. When you leave that food on your countertop under uncontrolled circumstances, then it may sour unexpectedly. It may also produce that wild lactococcus, may also produce other flavor compounds that are undesirable. But it could very well be the same microbe. The cheese that is spoiled by a mold, a green-blue mold on your cheddar cheese, could very well be Penicillium roqueforti, the very organism that that is responsible for a very fine cheese, of course, that we know as blue cheese or Roquefort cheese, could be the very same mold. It's under certain circumstances, controlled circumstances, that produces a desirable, acceptable outcome versus unacceptable.
Bob, do you personally try to make a point of eating certain fermented foods that contain live microbes? And if you do you try to feed them? Like, do you try to give some prebiotic in your diet to feed those little puppies?
So in my refrigerator right now, I have a few containers of yogurt. So that's kind of my go-to. I do have some miso in my refrigerator. At the moment, I looked this morning, I didn't have any kimchi or sauerkraut, and I will say that I grew up with that canned sauerkraut, and I thought it was horrible. And when they served that at school, I thought, who's eating this? But then as I became a food science professional and started working this field and have made my own sauerkraut and kimchi in class laboratory exercises and would go to the store and buy high quality non-heated products, I realized these are really fine tasting, good, nicely textured products. So I personally have adopted some of these into my diet. Of course, I still partake of a glass of red wine now and then, and that's a fermented food as well. I had an eye-opening experience about 10 years ago. I was in Japan as a visiting lecturer, and I was lecturing. It must have been about 150 students in Japan. I think they were sophomore, junior, food science majors. And I mentioned that I was trying to relate foods that they were familiar with to foods, the Western foods. And I said something about the miso that they consume is kind of like our yogurt in that they're a source of live microbes that can provide health properties. And they looked at me, and it wasn't the translation problem, but they looked at me kind of quizzically, and I realized they're consuming miso not for any health properties. It's part of their diet. And I think that sometimes we, you know, in the U.S., we consume some of these products because of their perceived health properties, which is fine. But in my view, fermented foods, just like other like fruits and vegetables, just ought to be part of a healthy diet without the expectations that it's going to fix your IBS or it's going to fix some health condition. And so I think that's good in my mind. To remember that people eat foods for their aesthetic property as much as anything else.
We have some wonderful sauerkrauts and kimchi in California, and I noticed that some of them do have probiotic on the label and some don't. Does that label mean anything to you?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And you can't label foods that way, in my view, because those fermented foods have no clinically proven health benefit. There's nothing in those foods related to what microbes are there or how many are there, their function. So in my view, that's ought not to be labeled that way. There's no law in the United States that prohibits those manufacturers from labeling a food as a probiotic, but I don't think it does. I think at best, it's confusing to consumers. And I think at worst, it's kind of false advertising. Because there's no health benefit associated with those foods. Now, the exception would be a yogurt or a kefir, and maybe other products as well, to which a established probiotic microbe is added to that food, to that yogurt. So that would be a legitimate use of the word probiotic yogurt or probiotic containing fermented food, is if you had added a established probiotic to that food.
I think we're going to wrap up, Bob, and I want to thank you really sincerely for all your discussions and all the interesting things you brought up. You said you've been working in this field for decades now. What's the most exciting thing happening in the fermented food research arena right now? Maybe we could finish up with that.
So I was just thinking about this, and again, the health properties are driving a lot of the research, but I think what's really made a big difference, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, are the interest among what I would call kind of the microbial ecologists and the systems biologists that have recognized that fermented foods are a great model to study microbial interactions of competition, antagonism, succession, and using molecular techniques in particular, we've been able to really understand the mechanisms that are involved in fermentation much better than we have in the past. So I think it's a welcome addition to see all these microbial ecologists and systems biologists that have entered the field and I really think have shed some really important information to the science.
I agree. And then, you know, wouldn't it make a great TV series as well? Succession, I think you called it, was it?
It's taken.
Listen, thanks, Bob. And I'll leave Dan to wrap up this issue of the podcast.
Thanks so much, Bob. Again, I mentioned Bob wrote the book on fermented foods. The book is Microbiology and Technology of Fermented Foods. It's in a second edition because it's so popular. And we're thrilled to have you as the first of what we hope are many podcasts in the future.
Thank you, guys. We really appreciate it.